Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter, and I just want to let you know that if you're a Wing Chun practitioner, especially from the WT or Leung Ting line, and you want to get really personalized intensive private training with me, you can now apply to do an immersion course with me here in NYC, or if you like the sun, in my Florida home near Orlando. These courses are for instructors or anyone who's serious about learning the art in detail and working hard. I teach in program blocks like Siunam Tao, Cham Kyu, Byuji, and Wooden Dummy, and those include the Chi Sao theory, fighting applications, and training methods as well. If you're really serious about learning Wing Chun, check out the link in the description below to find out about applying for a spot. And while you're here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube, like this video, and share it on your social media platforms. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the Genius will be discussing the Alex Ben Block Bruce Lee interview. Lots of gems. Lots of Jeet Kune Do, lots of what kind of Chinese karate did your sensei teach you, Bruce Lee? Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up?
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius.
Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Sifu. Doing real good right now.
Yeah, so here we are doing another Bruce Lee conversation.
Right. We don't know what episode this is.
We never know what episode it is, and when we think we know, we always get it wrong, right? So anyway, we've done the Dan Lee secretly recorded conversation.
Yes, four installments of it.
That's right. We did that in four installments because we just, cannot... Well, there was a lot to unpack there because... it was a private conversation. Everything was a little bit more off the cuff and way more unfiltered. So yeah. Bruce was saying a lot of things of substance in that phone conversation. In the last one we did, the Ted Thomas interview, that was...
One installment, right?
Yeah, it was 14 minutes, so it was a little bit shorter.
Yeah.
And also it was Bruce Lee kind of being public persona Bruce Lee, which is not as substantive in terms of the things that he says. And so this is another interview... that was done by Alex Ben Block, who was a young reporter at the time, also done over the phone. This was while Bruce Lee was in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And Alex Ben Block, I think a year after Bruce Lee's death, wrote a book called The Legend of Bruce Lee, where it was I think one of the first biographies about Bruce Lee. And he talked about Bruce Lee's death and talked about like the use of cannabis and stuff like that. So he was actually one of the first to talk about that, and that was like I think a year after his death or whatever. So Alex mm-hmm. Ben Block wasn't just some young reporter who interviewed Bruce Lee, but also later ended up writing a book. So
have you seen the History's Greatest Mysteries thing with Bay Logan yet?
So at the time of this recording, it's actually coming out today, so I have not seen it yet. All right. So thank you for asking me that. All right. So no, I haven't. I'll watch it when I get home.
All right.
I actually helped to arrange some interviews for that documentary.
So
I'm looking forward to see if they used the subjects that I suggested to them for that as well. So, of course, you never know because I know that they shot those interviews, but you never know if they use it in the final edit or whatever.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's on the History Channel. It's called The History's Mysteries, hosted by Lawrence Fishburne.
That's all new to me. I didn't even know until today.
They did an episode on Bruce Lee's death.
Mm.
And this was recorded. Bay Logan put it together, and Philip Chan. I don't know if you know who Philip Chan is.
I've heard of Philip Chan.
Philip Chan, if you've seen the movie Bloodsport, he's the inspector. When the two agents come from the U.S. to try to find Frank Dukes in Hong Kong, they go and talk to the local police inspector to get his help to find Frank Dukes, right, who's gone AWOL from the army. And so that actor is Philip Chan. And Philip Chan is a Hong Kong actor, but he also speaks English quite well. So he's a very suitable host for a TV show that's in English because his English is fantastic. And he's done a bunch of movies and he's been in films in Hong Kong. So, he's been around for a while.
I feel like I met this guy.
Well, no.
Like you met somebody we heard of recently. What's his name? You met the guy.
We'll talk about that in a moment.
You on to some dude in the CIA or something like that. What happened with this?
Well, I'll talk about that in a moment. So anyway, but the interesting thing about Philip Chan is he's not only an actor and he's in this History Channel, episode about Bruce Lee's death. But he originally was an actual police detective in Hong Kong.
Oh.
Which is why he often played the roles of like police inspectors and police detectives. And I had a chance to chat with him online about Tang Sang, one of my favorite topics, right?
Yeah.
And he actually knew Tang Sang. So Ooh. I hope that next time, I go to Hong Kong, whenever they allow us dirty foreigners back into their country, that I have a chance to talk to him about that, and as well as other
dirty
things.
Guaylo.
So I'm looking forward to having a chance to talk to him about lots of those kind of topics. So anyway, the histories, mysteries thing, I'm looking very much forward to that episode and see, what Bay and those guys have put together. So before we get started on the Alex Ben Block interview and kind of dissecting that a little bit. I generally try to guard my privacy as much as possible. Not so much like my private life, but just like access mm-hmm. to me. Because when you teach Wing Chun publicly the way I do, and now you have a podcast where you talk about Bruce Lee and all these kind of things, you tend to attract a lot of people who just want to kind of talk shop. Mm. And, sometimes they're obviously through the YouTube channel, I've met like tons of people who I otherwise wouldn't have met. Someone who I just kind of met because he likes the podcast is someone called Bruce Willow. And he's a Portuguese martial artist who has a YouTube channel, Bruce Willow. And he did a video where he basically copycats like scenes from movies. And he did a copycat scene of Snake and the Eagle's Shadow with Jackie Chan. Mm. And so there's like the scene where Jackie's training on his own and he kind of copycats it, where you see the Jackie Chan on top and then him on the bottom, right? And it's amazing. I mean, he's like a very well-built, very athletic martial artist. You know, he's kind of stocky, but he can do kicks and jumps and flips and stuff like that. And he has got a YouTube channel. And
check that out.
Yeah, Bruce Willows. He does amazing stuff. He's fantastic. And through doing this YouTube channel, I've had a chance to connect with him online. And
so Bruce Willis?
Bruce Willow.
Oh, Bruce Willow.
Man,
wow.
My bad. There you go. I get the same name. It's similar to when I teach you
name.
Wing Chun, right? I say Bruce Willow, you say Bruce Willis, and it's kind of how that's the translation error right there, right?
Yeah. It's bad.
So anyway, but on the downside of that, I have public social media like my Instagram and stuff like that. But, that's run by – I have a social media manager who runs that because I really don't have time for that. But people are always trying to kind of find a way to private message me. And kind of right now, I mean, people can leave comments. I usually, if I have time, I'll answer the comments if I have the time. And sometimes I'll answer I'll be a little snarky or whatever, but it's never like mean or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of cost-benefit analysis to answering someone's comment, right? Mm. But anyway, there was someone in the comments, and for those of you here on the channel, I've already deleted it because I'm not trying to call this guy out, right?
Yeah.
If he's a fan of the podcast, he likes the podcast, he can keep listening to the podcast. I don't want to like make him feel embarrassed, so I actually deleted the comment thread, so don't bother looking for it. But anyway, there was a guy in the comments was like, what's your email address? And I'm thinking like, why would I put my email address in the comments of a YouTube channel?
Yeah.
Like literally the last thing I want is like hundreds of people, because the problem is people.
You won't get any spam from that.
No. People start texting me like, yo, I know how Bruce Lee died.
Yeah.
Yo, I know this. Yo, I know that. And then it's kind of nonstop. And then suddenly they're in your DMs and they don't go away. All right. And so I try to avoid this only because my time is really limited. Like, I teach martial arts, I train, we do the podcast, and I spend time with my family and I have my projects. I really don't have a lot of time to go down some rabbit hole with someone who thinks that, Bruce Lee, is still alive or something like that, right? So anyway, this guy was like in the comments like, yo, could you send me your email address or like your Twitter or something like that? And so I was like, well, first of all, I'm like, if you're a fan of the podcast, like my Twitter handle and IG handle literally flashes on the screen like every 15 seconds, right?
Right,
so I'm like, sometimes you wonder, like, are these the same people who ask you a question that they could just Google? You know what I mean? Like, do you ask for directions to someone's place when you can just Google it, right?
These are the times we live in now.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? So anyway, I'm like, well, my Twitter handle's at the Kung Fu Genius. And then, like, some 15 minutes later, he comments like, oh, you need to open up your Twitter DMs, because my Twitter DMs are set up that I got to be connected with you to send me DMs, because on Twitter I get tons of stuff from people like, who is this person, right? So I'm like, all right. So I had to go in and change the settings on my Twitter DMs to accept public messages or whatever, right? So then here I'm like, all right, go ahead. Oh, no. And I'm just like waiting. Oh, no. So the guy's like, oh, I got some photos or I got some photos maybe you've never seen before or something like that, right? And I'm like, okay. And that's the reason why I did it. Because if look, as much as like I'm very protective of my time, but if someone legitimately has something like rare photos, yeah, or they have access to something, I will definitely give them some chance. Candy. Well, I would definitely give them the chance to send that to me, because one, we need content for the podcast.
Yeah.
And two, as just a Bruce Lee nut, like, man, if there are people out there who have stuff and they want to show me and haven't seen it before, man, I want to see it, right? Because I'm interested in
bring
this
it
stuff,
on.
Right? So anyway, you know, some 15 minutes go by and then I start getting messages from this guy. And he sends me a couple photos, and these are all photos that I've seen before. You know, in fact, I'm like, oh, yeah, actually, my friend Mguailung put this in his book, and like I have the book. Like I know, literally, I know this photo. Like I even know the guy who discovered the photo. Like my level of geekdom is not the deepest. There's some people out there who definitely know way more about Bruce Lee than I do, but I would say I'm not a white belt in Bruce Lee for sure. and so like, you know, okay, so I've seen these photos and so on, and then the guy's like, all right, well, the real reason I'm DMing you is because he has a friend, a higher up in the government, all right? In this specific higher, which is always like, all right. You know, the first thing for me, I'm like, did your friend tell you he's higher up in the government, right? Sounds like something an 18-year-old would tell some girl he's trying to woo, you know. You know, I actually work for the CIA. It sounds very Frank Dukes-ish, right? Yeah. Okay. Or Steven Seagal, you know, like they have these backgrounds. You know, actually, I work for the CIA. I'm not supposed to tell anyone, but I'll tell you because I like you.
Yeah.
Steven all right? Seagal did work for the CIA.
He did.
Sharon Stone said so in an interview.
That's true. That's true.
Well, that makes it legit.
Absolutely. It's totally legit.
Of course.
So anyway, you know, he's got a friend who works in, you know, in the government or whatever. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool.
The high up.
And high up. And he said that this guy knows, all right, because we all know that when it comes to matters of Bruce Lee's death, the U.S. government was all over that.
Oh, of course.
Especially, you know, when Bruce Lee died, his obituary was like a small blurb in the New York Times. Because remember, he really didn't become famous in the West until after Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like Bruce Lee's death was front page news in America the way it was in Hong Kong. But even in the obituary section, it wasn't even the main thing. It was like, it was like on the side, right? So to think that, you know, the U.S. government would be all over this.
They treated Bruce like a gay lefay.
Like a calife, yeah, exactly, right?
Oh,
and then, but of course, the U.S. government's all up in this business, like grimace, all right? And so, so anyway, the guy says, you know, his friend or whatever told him that actually Bruce Lee was poisoned, okay? But he didn't die. He was in a coma for a while, all right?
Coma-inducing poison.
Exactly, right? And then when he got out
of... How long was he in a coma?
It was very
indescript. Like a Steven Seagal movie coma.
Well, like most made-up conspiracy theories, there are huge yawning gaps in like the things you really need to know, but there's always certain details to explain away the obvious inconsistency. So like it literally is one of the most poorly constructed conspiracy theories I've ever heard. And it goes something like this. Bruce Lee was poisoned. He was in a coma. And when he got out of the coma, the U.S., he said, the same organization that runs the witness protection program, all right, like they put Bruce under witness protection program, all right, which is, first of all, why? Like none of those details are explained. Why? All right. They gave him plastic surgery to his ears and his eyebrows. I remember it said eyebrows and like one or two other things, right?
Eyebrows, and plastic surgery.
Yeah, and they retrained him on how to speak, all right? And and then because of his back injury, which very inexplicable, he can't really do martial arts because of his back injury and being in a coma. So he went to his number one passion of writing. Okay.
Which, so first no more martial arts.
No more martial arts.
He gave up martial arts.
He gave up martial arts for his real passion, which was writing. All right. Which, first of all, Bruce was an okay writer. He wasn't an amazing writer. He was good at screenplays and ideas, but I wouldn't say like Bruce's strong suit was a, like, you know, he's definitely
playwright.
Yeah. You know, I mean,
he went playwright.
Equate him like to, you know, he's like the J.D. Salinger of his time, right?
So there's plays out there that Bruce Lee wrote.
So he said, and so he had all this facial reconstructive surgery, and he retrained how to speak, and he is actually
how to speak proper.
No, differently, because he's under witness protection, so he has to just speak differently, right? And he is the famous playwright, David Henry Hwang. The guy who wrote, I think, like M. Butterfly or something like that, right?
Okay.
And so, I see this, and he's like, you know, if you look at Bruce's teeth, because like one of his, like, you know, the front, the tooth here in the front is like, on Bruce is like a little bit off. It's like not right. It's like right on center instead of off to the side. And then, like, you know, David Henry Hwang has the same thing. And when you look, and he sends me this photo and he's like, look. And it's like, and then he's, and I'm like, I literally wrote, oh my God, I opened my DMs for this. This is the most ridiculous thing that I have, like, as a Bruce Lee fan, I've heard some crazy shit. All right. And maybe I've heard some shit just as crazy as this David Henry Hwang thing, but I'll tell you what, I've never heard anything crazier. All right. And then he sends me these photos and I'm like, they don't look the same. He's like, oh, look at his mannerisms or whatever. All right. Now look. All right. First of all, David Henry Hwang has a history. He has existed before Bruce Lee died. You can literally Google his upbringing and see photos of him growing up.
Yeah.
And if you, all right, so when you're done listening to this podcast, I want you to go on YouTube
and look at the two
and type in David Henry Hwang and listen to an interview.
All right.
And ask me or ask yourself, does this guy sound like Bruce Lee? Would have been able to change his voice to sound like this guy? And think about it. He became a playwright. He never went to go see his kids again. He never went to go see his wife again. He literally abandoned this life to have a relatively high-profile life as a New York famous playwright. No, it is so unbelievably absurd because his tooth is the same, right?
A little. And I got to say that in the photos, Bruce Lee's tooth, I believe it's that front right tooth.
Yes.
But Hwang's...
It's the other one, right? Well, you don't understand.
It's the front left.
Yeah, well, you don't understand. It's part of the reconstructive surgery,
exactly.
Right? Of course, Bruce would... He's in the witness protection program, but they decide the best thing to do with him is to make him a famous playwright. All right? So we don't want anyone to know Bruce Lee's alive. Let's put him on Broadway. No one will notice. All right? I mean, like, come on. This is, like, so... What's crazy? I was literally in shock reading this. Because I thought this guy was just going to send me some photos or maybe tell me some interesting thing that he had heard. And he tells me this, and the dude is dead serious. Even the first time, I'm like, oh, my God, this is ridiculous. He answered, oh, I'm glad that you also see a resemblance. It's like, no, dude, no. You're literally not reading what I'm saying, all right?
This is ridiculous.
Meaning. This is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then I remembered something, Dre. I've met David Henry Hwang. I've met him before. All right? It took me a moment, and I was like, I freaking met this dude. Okay?
All right? This is the best part.
Yes. Okay? Because many years ago, he wrote a play about Bruce Lee called Kung Fu. Right. And basically it was a play about, you know, Bruce Lee, about aspects of Bruce Lee's life.
Lee wrote a play about himself.
Yeah, Bruce Lee wrote about
him. Who better?
The witness protection program told him to do that. Look, we need to keep you in hiding here. I think the best thing to do is for you to write a play about yourself.
That is the best thing for him to do.
Like, yes.
If you have drugs, right, because Bruce Lee,
right?
So consequently, the place you would put them, the last place they would look would be a big box that said drugs.
Right.
Because no one would actually do that.
Right.
So, I'm sorry, actually, I was unconvinced.
He's
up until
on
that.
Board.
Right, got it,
he's
got it,
on
got
board.
It. Yeah. This is called hiding in plain sight, all right? So anyway, they have this play. It was off Broadway. I think it was on 42nd Street. And the choreographer, his name is Manny.
Great.
He's a martial artist. I've known him for a few years. He actually came here to City Wing Chun to take a few lessons from me.
Oh, right.
Because he needed to train the cast in the Wing Chun stuff, because there were a couple scenes in the play where, like, the Bruce Lee character is teaching them, like, Wing Chun, right? Okay. So Manny came to me to actually do some Wing Chun lessons. I taught him the Siu Nam Tao form. I taught him a couple little basics, Pak Sao, Lap Sao, things like that. And then as a kind of a thank you, he invited me to, like, I think a pre-screening of the show.
Wow.
And David Henry Hwang was there, okay? And
it's
so
his
I
show.
Saw, yeah, it was because he wrote it. It's his screenplay, right? And so I saw the show, and it was cool because when the actor, his name's Cole, who played Bruce Lee, when he's teaching the Siu Nam Tao form to his students, it was actually our Siu Nam Tao form, yeah. Right? And so afterwards, I got to meet him, and then I got to meet David Henry Hwang, who was there, right? And I shook his hand.
Oh, wow.
And I exchanged a few words with him.
So you got to shake
Bruce Lee's
hand.
And I tell you what, the last thing that I felt was, this dude's got an aura of Bruce Lee.
The Bruce Lee dar wasn't going off.
Yeah, my Bruce Lee dar, all right? That radar I have for detecting people who are secretly Bruce Lee,
yeah,
which has saved me many a time,
yeah,
did not go off in that moment. And then so here, and this dude was dead serious, right? First of all, this is so ridiculous because David Henry, I can't say his name, save my life. David Henry Hwang has, like, literally, like, you can go and, like, find out about his history, and they're old photos of him when he was young. All right? I mean, this dude has existed before Bruce Lee's death.
Are they the same age in any way?
I guess, correlated. Right? But I mean, like, literally the guy was working out there before Bruce Lee died.
Right,
so this idea, right. Like, you know, like, this guy was never even known until after 73 is kind of, like, ridiculous, right?
Mm.
So anyway, this guy was serious, but this is the reason why I keep my DMs private.
Mm.
That's some real, like Bill Hicks, Alex Jones conspiracy.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That was Alex Jones level for sure.
Well, you know, because you've heard that conspiracy that Alex Jones is actually Bill Hicks.
The comedian?
Yes.
Makes sense.
Like, 100%. Like, Bill Hicks never died. He just Alex Jones. Even though Alex Jones is, like, 12 years younger than he is.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like, oh, well, but, you know, you look at them up in photos, and all you put photos together,
right.
They're both, like, basically round-faced Texans,
yes,
right?
Yes,
and
yes,
they both shout a lot, except, you know, Alex Jones is crazy right-wing conspiracy theorist, and all the fans are like, well, it would make sense that Bill Hicks would do that because he's just trolling his audience. And you're
right.
Just like...
Yes, confirmation bias in these things is very rich. I mean, like, if you decide that that's the narrative, all you need... It's so easy to connect the dots any way you want. Look, they have a... vague resemblance in one or two photos.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this guy became famous after 73. There you go, right? And based on this, like, extremely ridiculously thin, you can't even call it evidence, all right? It's barely anecdotal, right? And what people don't realize is the plural of anecdotes is not evidence. Okay, and so, like, it's just ridiculous. So anyway, we spent enough time talking about that nonsense. Let's talk about this
Alex Ben Block
interview with Bruce Lee. Let's get started.
Let's
go ahead there, Mikey.
Let's get to it.
I want to ask you a little biography first. You were born in San Francisco, I understand.
Right, 1940, November 27th, Sagittarius.
Ah, a diplomat. And you moved to Hong Kong shortly after?
Yes, when I was 3 months old.
3 months old, you moved to Hong Kong?
Yes.
And you were educated in Hong Kong?
Partly, when I was, you know, up to around 18 years old,
uh-huh.
I moved back to the States, and I was attending the University of Washington in Seattle.
I see. What was your major?
Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Philosophy, man.
I understand you were a child actor in Hong Kong.
So obviously there it talks about some, you know, basic, you know, biography stuff that he was born in San Francisco, but he grew up in Hong Kong. And then he went to school at the University of Washington in Seattle. So these are all things we know. But it's interesting because, you know, these are things we've read about or whatever. But, it's nice to hear it coming from his mouth. Like, I think it's the only time you ever hear him say the name Seattle, right? And so it's interesting to hear him say this stuff. We all know it, but, like, it's nice to kind of hear it coming from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So now he's talking about being a child actor. So let's continue.
Well, mainly, I'm the important thing.
They're very important to me. For instance,
so up to around when I was 18 years old, I did something like, a co-starring role. Other than that, it's kind of like, not that important.
Were you in things with your father?
Well, no, not really. My father was in a Chinese opera.
Yeah, so he talks about he was a child actor, but basically he played secondary roles. You know, he wasn't like the main actor. He said up until he was 18, because I believe when he was 18, that's when he had the role of the orphan, which was like his main role, right?
I'd see this movie.
And you know what's interesting about that? If you ever have a chance to see it, you know, Bruce, like, he plays kind of the troubled teen. And if you watch it, when we went to the Hong Kong Heritage Museum, they had clips of it there. And you can tell that Bruce was training Wing Chun really hardcore at that time, because it's like more when he's like 18 years old. When you see the film, when you look at his hands, his bottom three knuckles are super red, and you see it on both. And you see it on both, because I notice these things. I'd be like, been doing martial arts my whole life, right? So when I meet people who, you know, do striking martial arts, whether it's karate, boxing, or Wing Chun, I always look at their hands, right? Mm-hmm. People who do grappling, you look at their ears. So I'm like always very keen on these kind of signs, right? And I remember seeing the clip from there, because they had like a nice color print of it. And you look at Bruce's hands and you see that his bottom three knuckles on both hands are chewed up, clearly from wall bag training, because he's training Wing Chun at that time. And
so cool.
Yeah, super, super interesting. So let's continue.
Never did like that, you know.
Yeah.
I'd rather like, you know, to watch the Lone Ranger, you know.
I understand your father was fairly famous in the Chinese opera.
Yes, he was.
Is he still alive?
Oh, he passed away in 1965.
What was his name?
So he was talking, obviously continuing to talk about his father, and then talk about his father being in Chinese opera, which is obviously different from Hong Kong films. And he even said he didn't have any interest in that. He would much rather watch The Lone Ranger, which is pretty funny, right? typical of kids that time. Yeah, I think what people don't realize is already by the 1950s and 1960s, the popularity of Cantonese opera had waned considerably in Hong Kong. Like, the only people who are watching those or going to those were the older generation Chinese. And this is the reason why, coming out of the 60s, the opera troupes, like Jim Yoon's opera troupe, Jim Yoon was the sifu of Sammo and Jackie and all of those. They called that opera troupe the Cha Siufu, which is the Seven Little Fortunes. They were earning less, because basically what happens is these kids are basically put on consignment to the opera schools. Like, these poor families, they cannot raise these kids. So they basically sell them to the opera school. And that's what they did at that time in the 50s. Like, Jackie Chan's parents basically sold him off to the opera school, same with Sammo and them. And they live there in like a dormitory. And every day they train in opera, and they do gymnastics and martial arts and singing and acrobatics and everything like that. And then they pay off their room and board and training by doing opera performances for the guy who owns it. So basically they're like, they're essentially indentured servants to the sifu, who trains them in opera, and then they go out and make money for the opera school, right? And they're on a contract until, I guess, they're like 18 years old. And the problem was, at that time, there were less and less opera performances that were really making any money. And this is the reason why those opera actors pivoted into becoming stuntmen for films, because there was no money in opera anymore. And you can even hear the tone in Bruce's voice, like, yeah, when he was a kid, like, he wasn't into that stuff, you know what I mean? We think like, oh, the older generation was into it, but already by the 50s and 60s, man, they weren't having that, because that was considered, even at that time, a really traditional art form, and the want for that was definitely waning. All right, let's continue.
H-O-I
Chuan. I see. How many languages do you speak?
Well, Cantonese.
Yes.
English. And a little bit of Mandarin.
That's interesting, because in the Pierre Burton interview, he told Pierre Burton, first of all, I only speak Cantonese, right? And then here, he says he speaks a little bit of Mandarin, all right? Now, for people who don't understand, the difference between Cantonese and Mandarin is both straightforward and a bit complicated.
Yeah.
Because Cantonese is different from Mandarin in one way. I'm not talking about the pronunciation. In Mandarin, the written form is the same as the spoken form. So basically, the way you write it in formal Chinese is the way you say it in Mandarin.
Hmm.
But Cantonese is not that way. In Cantonese, they have the formal written form, which would be the same as the way it's written in for Mandarin speakers. But the way they speak Cantonese is not the same as the written form. They have different characters that they use for everyday speech, and they have different phrases and different ways of expressing themselves that are not in the written form. So that means that people who grew up in Hong Kong, they can speak Cantonese, which is done in a very colloquial way, but they can read formal Chinese. So that means that people who grew up in Hong Kong, even if they cannot sound out Mandarin sounds, they can essentially read the way Mandarin is spoken. So that means a lot of Cantonese speakers, they understand how Mandarin is spoken. They just literally need to learn how to pronounce the same characters in Mandarin. But in Cantonese, they have different characters that don't exist in Mandarin. They have shortcuts. They have different ways of phrasing things. And sometimes even the word order is different. But Cantonese speakers from Hong Kong essentially learn two systems. They learn an informal spoken way that they speak.
Wow.
And then there's a formal written way. And those are both with traditional characters. And it's interesting, like sometimes people who grew up in Taiwan, they still use traditional characters, which is different from mainland China, which use disgusting simplified characters. Sorry, we love China. I love simplified characters. They helped improve illiteracy rates. I love simplified characters. They're beautiful. So traditional characters, they still use them in Taiwan and they use them in Hong Kong. But someone from Taiwan can read, like, you know, obviously the formal Chinese, but someone from Taiwan cannot really read a gossip rag from Hong Kong, because a gossip rag would not be written in formal Chinese. It would be written in the more colloquial local Cantonese, and there would be a bunch of characters in there that they wouldn't understand or not quite understand the use, even though they might kind of know it. So Cantonese is like a coded Chinese, but they also can read the standard one. So that means that Bruce, growing up in Hong Kong, obviously would have learned to read formal Chinese, and he spoke colloquial Cantonese. So he really only needs to learn the Mandarin pronunciations of those words, and he would essentially know Mandarin, right? But here he actually says he speaks some Mandarin, whereas in the Pierre Burton interview, he says he speaks only Cantonese, right? So it's curious if maybe he was, you know, I'm not 100% sure of the timeline of this interview. I'd be curious if this was before or after the Pierre Burton one. Now, I'm going to say that because he says he speaks some Cantonese, I'm going to just speculate this is after the Pierre Burton interview.
Okay.
So, because maybe he's learned some, and you know who spoke Mandarin? Betty Ting Pei.
Oh, he got to hook up somehow.
Betty Ting, here's the thing. Betty Ting Pei, she was an actress from Taiwan. In Taiwan, they speak Mandarin. But because Betty was making films in Hong Kong, she had to learn to speak Cantonese. I have heard Betty speak Cantonese on recent interviews, because she's been living in Hong Kong for a very long time, and she speaks Cantonese now fine. But at the time of Bruce Lee's death, they did an interview with her very shortly after Bruce Lee died. And I recently listened to it. I think there's a YouTube channel called Sifu Subtitles. He sometimes follows our episodes as well. And he takes old Chinese stuff and he'll put subtitles on it, like clips, even Wing Chun stuff, stuff with Leung Ting, stuff with Bruce Lee. He'll just subtitle it for Western audiences so they have a chance to actually hear what's going on. Let's He's got a small channel, but Sifu Subtitles on YouTube, for you guys who are really into Wing Chun and Kung Fu and just you want to see stuff with subtitles, it's kind of rare. He does it. That's his thing. And he's really fantastic.
Mm.
I believe it was on his channel, although I could be mistaken, because I think this is up on a couple places in YouTube. There was an interview with Betty shortly after Bruce Lee's death. And I heard her speak Cantonese then, because most of the Cantonese I've heard her speak is like now, where she's already been living in Hong Kong for many years. And then I heard how she spoke Cantonese then, which is obviously around the time that she was with Bruce Lee. And she kind of pretty liberally mixed Mandarin and Cantonese and spoke Cantonese with a very heavy Mandarin kind of influence and word choice and word order. So at that time that her and Bruce, I guess, would have been together, he by default would have known some Mandarin just speaking with her, because her Cantonese was a little shoddy, to be quite honest, at that time. So anyway, let's continue. Hey, Kung Fu Genius listeners, are you a fan of Wing Chun Kung Fu? Well, if you listen to me, I assume you are. I got great news for KFG fans. Right now, you can get an all-access one-month free trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. Yes, I said free. Go to wcinewsstand.com and register in the upper right-hand corner, fill out your email and password, and use the code KFGTRIAL to get your free trial to all the issues from 2011 to the current issue. That's right, all the issues, even the one with this cool guy on the cover. That's me for those of you listening to us on audio. My Kung Fu Genius column is also in all the new issues, as if you needed another reason to get this awesome magazine. Go get your free trial subscription today. For all that information, check out the description below. And now back to me.
And you make your films now in Chinese, I understand.
In Mandarin,
yeah. In Mandarin, they're made.
I love how Alex Ben Block doesn't realize, like, you make them in Chinese, though, right? You just told me you spoke Mandarin and Cantonese, but the movies, they're made in Chinese, though, right? It's like, yes. There are two main forms of Chinese and multiple dialects after that as well. All right, continue.
Was your mother in the theater, too?
No.
No?
No.
What is your nationality? What do you feel your nationality is?
U.S., of course, because I hold a U.S. passport.
I see.
And, I mean, as soon as I finish with all these, you know, things here, I would like to move, you know, back and, you know, just stay there, you know?
Yeah, suck it, Quentin Tarantino. Oh, Bruce Lee didn't like American stuntmen. Bruce Lee literally just said he identified as being American. Because he's a U.S. passport holder and he identified as being American. And what else did he say? Then when he's done doing these films, he wants to go back to the States. I think people didn't realize that because he had all this success in Hong Kong, but Hong Kong was just a backdoor for him to get into Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
And he finally had his movie Enter the Dragon, and I think he was probably going to do a couple more Chinese films, but he wanted to come back to Hollywood because that was his main goal to begin with. He actually didn't plan on staying in Hong Kong for that, you know, permanently. It's just that he happened to die there. So there's this assumption that he was now based in Hong Kong and that was going to be kind of it. But in reality, that was part of his plan to go back to the States. Yeah. And he literally says it right there that that this was kind of a part-time thing. I believe either through some letters or maybe some things that I read, he probably, I remember reading something like he was probably going to transition after a little bit. So maybe he'd make like a film in Hong Kong and then a film in the U.S. And then he would kind of go back and forth until he's eventually either only working in the States or only working on the projects that are going to, you know, give him the most or that are the most interesting. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, go ahead and continue.
May I ask, what is your height? How tall are you?
5'7.5".
And your weight?
140.
You know who else is 5'7.5"?
You.
Me. I always like, it's one of like, you know, the things that excites me the most. Like, I'm such a Bruce Lee fan, and I'm like, I'm also exactly 5'7.5".
Not 140, though.
I'm not 140. No. I'm right now.
Ethan's around 140. I see him.
He could be, yeah.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm a little heavier. I'm about 170, right? So you have to imagine I'm the same height as Bruce Lee. I have a little bit of that post-surgery weight.
Okay.
But my weight usually fluctuates between, I'm usually in the low 160s, right? But I'm 170 now. It's kind of post-surgery stuff. But I also have a very different like frame than Bruce Lee had.
Right.
And but for me, it's always like I'm the same height as Bruce Lee, right? It's one of the things I like the most. But he's definitely bullshitting about his weight there. He was not 140 pounds at this time.
Probably 135.
No, he was in his 120s. All right, I know it's because literally from November of 1972 when he visited his doctor, it was around the time before he was going to have the sweat glands removed. One of the problems he had was keeping on weight, and literally it was like he was in the low, I think, 120s or one at that time, and that was on the doctor's report. So Bruce is not 140 pounds here. He's bullshitting that. Yeah, right?
That's a classic symptom of someone that does too much cocaine, by the way.
Right.
Lying and bullshit.
Inflating his weight a little bit, right? because he definitely, I believe, he was 140 when he was in the States. Okay. But it'd be hard pressed to think that he was ever 140 when he was in Hong Kong.
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah, and plus, we've been to the Hong Kong Heritage Museum. Yeah. They have his clothes there on mannequins.
Yeah, those clothes look like Prince wore those clothes.
Like Prince wore those clothes, right? You see him there, and you look at that 27-inch waist.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, because, again, I'm 5'7", I look at that glass case at another 5'7 frame. If I even tried to put those clothes on, they would rip off like the Incredible Hulk.
Right, right.
Like, I don't even think I could. I mean, I have, like, really thick legs. I don't even think both of the pant legs can go over one of my legs, yeah. Right? And to think that he was 140 pounds.
How much did he weigh during Into the Dragon?
He must have been around 120 pounds. The low 20s for sure.
What?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. All right, let's continue.
And you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. What is your religion?
None whatsoever.
None? Do you believe in God?
To be perfectly frank, I really do not.
Okay. Did you ever have any other jobs besides being an actor?
Yes. I was teaching martial arts.
In the United States?
Yes.
In San Francisco or Los Angeles?
Well, I had three schools, one in Oakland, one in Seattle, one in Los Angeles.
Yeah, so just the reminder also about all the people like, oh, you know, Bruce Lee's just an actor. It's like, well, not really. He was like a kind of a child actor. He did a bunch of movies, but, you know, he was obviously going to school and doing martial arts. And through most of the time that he was in the States, he was actually actively teaching and practicing martial arts, right? So this idea, like, again, because the new generation, they just see him in the movies and they listen to whatever Joe Rogan and co. decide is the narrative about Bruce Lee. And, yeah, I mean, for the most part, he was teaching martial arts, doing martial arts, and training other martial artists.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie thing came very late in life, in the last 2.5 years of his life, right? So, let's continue.
Closed, you know, and just more private lessons.
What were they called?
My type of martial arts.
Well, you're in Jeet Kune Do? Is that what the school is called, the Jeet Kune Do School?
Well, actually, you know, I do not believe in school, you know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether you have read my Black Belt magazine article.
Yes, I have.
You have. Well, you know, more and more I believe, you know, here is you have two hands and two legs. And the thing is how you make good use of yourself, and that's about it. I mean, style kind of restricts you to one way of doing it, and therefore limiting your human capacity, you know?
Yeah, so he's kind of echoing some of the stuff he talked about in the Ted Thomas interview, like he doesn't believe in styles and stuff. But it must be a little frustrating for Bruce because, like, the normal reporters at that time, I mean, they were just not... It's very difficult because he's definitely on his own wavelength in terms of his philosophy and what he's doing. And, like, the reporters are always looking for straight kind of black and white answers.
Yeah.
And he's like, so you taught martial arts? Yes. Okay, what was the name of the school? And he's like, what do you mean, the style?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you taught Jeet Kune Do. Is that the name of the school? Well, I don't really believe in schools. Like, I can see where that's kind of frustrating for Alex Ben Block because he's like, you know, he wants to hear like, yes, I taught for 12 years and the name of my school was the Green Dragon Martial Arts School and we have three locations. It's like, no, I mean, most of Bruce's schools, whether we're talking about Taki in Seattle or you talk about James Yim Lee in Oakland or his school in L.A., which was later carried on by Dan Inosanto, for the most part, they weren't even really public. You know, they were kind of like you had to know someone there and you had to kind of know,
okay,
you know, I'm exaggerating, but you almost had to know the secret handshake to get in, right? It wasn't like this idea like a commercial school on La Cienega Boulevard in Beverly Hills or something like that. This is like, you gotta kind of be a bit of an insider to know, right? And I think that's something that, you know, think about Alex Ben Block as a young reporter at that time. You're thinking of martial arts schools more in the big commercial chains that are like, you know, in the strip malls and, you know, those big prominent ones and not thinking of someone who teaches, but teaches on a smaller scale and is a lot more serious about like his art than about the commercialization of it, right? So I think that that's difficult for him. And I love how he says Jeet Kune Do, right?
Okay. Jeet.
Jeet, right?
Jeet Kune Do.
It's funny, you know, my late podcast partner, Big Sean Madigan, who was a Jeet Kune Do instructor, but was also a very Brooklyn, New Yorker. When he said Jeet Kune Do, it always sounded like he said chicken dough, like chicken dough, right? And someone, I remember shortly before Big Sean passed last year, someone on Twitter, there was like an 1 week we didn't have an episode. He's like, oh man, I miss Big Sean saying chicken dough. And then I sent that to him, the screenshot of that. And he was like, who is this guy? I'll murder him, right? And he thought it was really funny, right? And then after that guy said that, every time I would listen to Sean, I cannot help but hear chicken dough.
Chicken dough.
You know, like all these chicken dough guys, chicken dough, right? It's arguably so not great. An easy martial art to say for Westerners because the J sound in Cantonese is not like this. It's not z like jeet, and it's not zh, it's not a jarring one either. It's a jeet. Jeet. And jeet is a very low level tone. It's, I believe, the sixth tone, so it's the lowest of the six tones.
Jeet.
So it's not jeet or jeet, it's jeet.
Jeet.
Very low, right? Jeet. And then kun. Kun is a falling tone, fist. You don't say kun, qn, kun, right? Kun. Kun is like falling, right? And then do. Do is also low. So actually, they're all low level tones. So it's not
kun is kun the five.
Kun is fist. Kun is fist.
Is it the five?
No, it's four.
It's the all four. Right? Yeah. Okay.
So it's all low level tones, right? Mm. But it's hard because English is not a tonal language. So people usually have either a flat tone or apply high tones every jeet kun do, right? And like for Chinese ear, this is gibberish.
Yeah.
All right. This is jeet kun do, right? Jeet kun do is much lower, right?
Oh,
so so it's just funny because like people would hear this and then hear like Bruce is explaining to him this stuff. And I hear Bruce is on a certain wavelength going like, I got to explain this shit again. And Alex Ben Block is like coming from the give me the straight answer. Tell me your school is called the Jeet Kune Do Bruce Lee School. You know what I mean? And he's not getting that type of answer, right? So let's continue.
You said in Black Belt that man, the living creature, the creating individual, is always more important than any established style. Does this mean that you change your style all the time in karate?
I mean this. I mean that man is always in a learning process.
Uh-huh.
Whereas style is a concluding, established, solidified something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you cannot do that, you know, because you learn every day as you grow on.
When did you begin studying the martial arts?
So he's referencing, he said, oh, did you read the Black Belt article, right? And I believe he's referencing the article where Bruce was on the cover. Charles Damiano actually had that one on the episode that he did here. It's the one, it's in the 70s. It's the one where Bruce has the mustache.
Oh.
And he's just got those sweet kicks. Yeah. He's doing that really slick kick. And the article was Liberate Yourself from Classical Karate. And basically it was like a brutal takedown of like the rigidity of kind of the classical mindset in martial arts, which is interesting because now many adherents of Jeet Kune Do, especially those who are like very much just want to do it the way he did it, they're to a certain degree also very mired in the classic idea of, you know, Bruce had this amazing philosophy and now we need to do it just the way he did it. And his philosophy was anything but that, right? Jeet Kune Do was a very difficult thing to explain now because Bruce did not want it to be a formalized martial art. And it, to a certain degree, it has become. And then there's a lot of arguments. What is the actual nature of that, right? And surprise, surprise, if you talk to someone who's a more classic, original JKD guy, they're going to tell you, they're going to present to you X, Y, Z reasons why the Jeet Kune Do should essentially be preserved more or less the way Bruce Lee taught it in his Tan Fan Kung Fu and all that kind of stuff. And the more concepts, people are going to tell you how it should be an integration of martial arts that follow a similar concept or a similar aim or something like that, right? And so you say stuff like that, people are going to argue with you on that stuff. But the moment they tell you what side of the team they're on, you don't need to hear their arguments because it's all copy and paste.
Yeah.
If someone is a Jeet Kune Do concepts adherent, then all the reasons for why Jeet Kune Do needs to develop and move this way and mix all this stuff, it's all copy and paste.
Mm.
And if someone is an original JKD, like you got to do it the way Bruce Lee did it, all their justifications are cut, copy, and paste, right? And at this point, I've read all that stuff, right? So, I mean, I'm Michael Jackson eating the popcorn when those guys are going at it online, right?
I gotta read this Bruce Lee.
But this is like a whole thing there going on between the two of them.
Bruce Lee.
Yeah. I gotta read. So now he's gonna talk to him a little bit about his martial arts history.
Did you study with any famous sensei?
Well, I studied under YIT MAN.
Uh-huh.
Chinese, it's a Chinese art.
That is the name of a man or the name of the art?
The name of my instructor.
I see. And what form of the martial arts was that?
The style is WING. And then CHUN.
Uh-huh.
We still get faked out because I believe nowhere on recording does Bruce actually say Wing Chun. I always just want to hear Bruce say Wing Chun.
Yeah.
And there is the closest we have. W-I-N-G-C-H-U-N. He doesn't just say
it. Why do you think he spelled
it out? Because he knows the reporter is going to butcher it.
Yeah.
Because first of all, Wing Chun is like, even now you still have to spell it. And now you have different spellings, like we use T-S-U-N or whatever. I mean, it's like you want to know the martial art that I do? Here, sit down, let me give you a short history lesson so I can tell you why we spell it this way, right?
Notice he spelled Y-I-P.
Y-I-P, right? All right, friends don't let friends spell it I-P, right? Okay. It's interesting because it seems that in legal documents, Ip Man used I-P, but everywhere else he used Y-I-P. And of course, the problem is that there's no standardized romanization for Cantonese in English. Like, I mean, if you want to romanize Cantonese words using our alphabet, mm-hmm. it's not standardized the way Mandarin is with pinyin. There's a standard way to transcribe Mandarin Chinese into the alphabet. But Cantonese, there's not. There's a few different systems, but those are usually just for people who are learning Cantonese, and they're not widely accepted by people who transcribe it, right? So that's why even when you go to Hong Kong, you'll see the signs of places, the same Chinese character on two different sides of the town transcribed different ways, right?
Hmm.
And so like, for example, the name Choi, sometimes you see it spelled C-H E-U-I, and sometimes C-H U-I, and sometimes T-S-U-I, and so it could all be the same Chinese character, right? And you wouldn't know because it's not standard. So that's why if you don't see the Chinese character, you're kind of guessing as far as that goes. Whereas in Mandarin, with the pinyin, they have the tone marker in there. You can literally, you don't even need to learn Chinese characters to learn Mandarin. You can literally read pinyin with the tone markers and speak it pitch perfectly without even knowing how to read Chinese. So that I have to give them, the mainland Chinese government one up on the Hong Kong government for having created that. So anyway, yeah, you hear him say Y-I-P-M-A-N, and the guy's like, is that the name? But first, I love how he says, what sensei did you learn under?
Yeah. Like,
oh,
Bruce,
man.
Is like, ah.
Yeah, it's not a sensei, right? First of all, sensei, which is obviously a Japanese title for Japanese martial art instructors, but the character sensei in Chinese, those same characters, mean xinsang, which literally means mister in Chinese, right? So it's not the same meaning at all. But it's just like typical of that time. I mean, obviously he's a reporter, he's very intelligent and he's very well read. So he has heard the word sensei, assumes that that's used across the board, not realizing that it's literally only for Japanese and you're talking to a Chinese dude here, right? So obviously the correct term would be sifu, right? Not sensei. And then like Bruce is like, Y-I-P-M-A-N. He's like, is that the name of a man? Like Yip Man, yeah, his name is the Yip Man. No, it's like that's literally his name, and the style is W-I-N-G-C-H-U-N. But still, I don't even know if it's in the Cantonese recordings. But like, I don't think there's a recording of Bruce. I mean, that's public saying the words Wing Chun, right? Just like that. And here we get really close, and he doesn't quite say it. All right, so let's continue.
These former karate,
well, actually, you cannot call it a Chinese form of karate because karate came after the Chinese kung fu. I mean, it's Chinese kung fu, actually.
Oh, it's kung fu.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, all these, you know, karate and all these things came after that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you know, so it's a form of karate, right? Okay, like karate is the generic term for martial arts. Of course, nowadays, wow. we kind of, I mean, you know, to be fair to Alex Ben Block, I mean, the amount of information that was available on Asian martial arts at that time was very limited. And mm-hmm. in the States, you really only had karate and maybe judo, right? Should have had Google back then. Yeah, the Google wasn't that good, right? No. Yo, man, I never saw Bruce Lee actually sparring with some dude for real. You know, it's, because Bruce's cell phone at that time had potato-level quality, right? As I like to say, right?
It's not like nowadays. They're filming it like, man, this quality sucks. Potato. I gotta delete this video.
Yeah, they've all been deleted, right? he didn't back it up to the cloud. That's why you don't have it, right?
That's why.
So, I mean, like, to be fair to Alex Ben Block, he has done research about martial arts. Otherwise, he wouldn't know words like sensei and karate and stuff like that. But, yeah, it's kind of funny to say to a Chinese person, like, one, is that a form of karate? And not realizing that, you know, Okinawan karate has some of its roots in Chinese martial arts, right? And it's kind of like a silly thing to say, especially to a Chinese person, right? And so let's continue.
You do what you do. How long have you been married?
Oh, I've been married now for around 9 years.
9 years. What is your wife's name?
Linda.
Linda. Is she Chinese or American?
She's American.
Is she Chinese or American? Isn't Bruce American and Chinese? Yeah. But again, it was the 70s. I'll go easy on him. All right.
You know what I find so fascinating so far is that, like, he's literally asking questions. I feel like he's in, like, an immigration interview or something. There's no actual substance to the rest of the interview.
Right.
He asks a question, he answers it, and then it's another question.
Right. You know what I mean? But I don't know what the interview is for. So he did say at the beginning he needed some biographical information. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling he's getting like the who, what, where, when, why, and how stuff first before he gets to the story. I don't know what this article was for. I mean, obviously he later went on to write an entire book about Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. But he seems just to be kind of like fact-checking stuff right now. All right, let's continue.
What are your hobbies? What do you do to relax?
What do I do to relax?
Yes.
Work. And work out and doing the things that I want, like taking movies and things like that.
Yeah, some people ask me, like, you know, somebody in the comments wanted to say, like, ask me anything episode, like, oh, do you know what Bruce Lee did to relax? And it's like, well, first of all, of all the things you could emulate about Bruce Lee, I think, like, taking it easy and relaxing and, like, giving yourself and your body some time to rest is probably, you wouldn't look to Bruce for inspiration on that, all right? Bruce was definitely the definition of burning the candle at both ends, right?
It's much better experts at that.
Exactly, right? You look at Bruce for like someone who's about like being determined and get stuff done and to be incredibly industrious and always moving forward and dealing with obstacles. You don't look at him as like the arbiter of like how to live a balanced life. I mean, the man died at 32 from something that definitely seemed like it was things that were going on in his life that could have been prevented, right? So that I find kind of interesting. And then what does Bruce say? Like in very typical Bruce, but also typical of many Hong Kong Chinese, because it's such a very difficult city to live in, because it's so expensive. It's like, well, I like to work out. I like to work and work on movies and stuff, right? So let's continue.
Practicing Jeet Kune Do.
Average around 2 hours a day.
About 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
And there Bruce Lee says he works out about 2 hours a day, right? Include, you know, his martial training, his strength training, and so on. Now, of course, you know, when he's on the set, he's also being very active and, you know, he might also be doing more than that. But he's saying like on the average about 2 hours a day kind of minimum, and definitely on some days he would do more, right? But this idea, like nowadays, people are like, oh, Bruce Lee trained 8 hours a day. When? And when did he have time to make movies or do anything else, right? In what world? Who can train 8 hours a day? You just literally wouldn't work. And then people go, well, see, because he was training 8 hours a day, that's why he died of exhaustion. I go, no, this is just confirmation bias, all right? You know, like you are saying he worked out 8 hours a day. No one else is. Even Bruce Lee in this interview is saying he worked out 2 hours a day. You are saying he worked 8 hours a day and then saying that's what killed him. But you're the one who said that. That isn't, you have to go with the evidence. You can't just say, well, see, he died young because he was, because of exhaustion, because he was working 8 hours a day. Therefore, he was working 8 hours a day. Like that's not how you confirm your own made up facts. Right. All right. Let's continue.
The difference, you said something in the Black Belt article that there's no difference between a Japanese martial artist and a Chinese martial artist who come to Jeet Kune Do. Can you explain?
Well, you see, like many people mm-hmm. who come to instructors, mm-hmm. Most of them, they say, hey man, like, what is the truth? You know, would you hand it over to me?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, one guy would say, now, I'll give you my Japanese way of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And another guy would say, I'll give you the Chinese way of doing this. To me, that's all baloney, because unless they are manned with three hands, or they are manned with four legs,
mm-hmm.
there are different ways of doing it. But mm-hmm. if you only have two hands and two legs, nationalities don't mean anything. I mean, these, you can say there are different approaches, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Each certainly must not limit to one approach.
Yes.
We must approach it with ourselves, you know? Art is the expression of ourselves. Whereas if you go to a Japanese style, then you are expressing the Japanese style. You are not expressing yourself.
You also say that life is a constant process of relating in talking about Jeet Kune Do.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you see, because, for instance, when I see a Japanese martial artist, I can see the advantage and I can see the disadvantage. In that sense, I'm relating to them, you see. And man is living in a relationship. Mm-hmm. And in relationship, we grow, you see.
Yes.
Yeah, so obviously he's talking, you know, a lot about some very common topics in kind of Bruce Lee lore about not really believing in there being these different ways of fighting because we only have two hands and two legs. And unless a human being was constructed in another way, you know, essentially this kind of not like going to be such a drastic different way of doing things is why he thinks maybe there's a Japanese approach or a Chinese approach, but not to think of it as, you know, a totally different way of fighting because we're basically all trying to solve the same issue, right? And that's why he said nationalities don't really matter about these things, right? And that was very revolutionary at that time because, I mean, martial arts at the time were extremely tribal. I mean, to be fair, martial arts are still very tribal, all right? So, you know, he was talking about stuff that even in 2021, we have to almost sadly say is still way beyond what a lot of people think about, right? And that, in my opinion, just makes him all the more remarkable.
Yeah.
So, but he said, you know, about the idea of constantly relating. He says when he looks at a Japanese martial artist, he can see the advantages and the disadvantages and to look at it in that kind of open way without the bias of, you know, oh, okay, what they call liking bias, right? Okay, well, I kind of like this thing or I like this person. Therefore, everything that kind of comes along with that package, I will excuse it a little bit and allow it to slide, even things that I find are not really great about it because I like that thing, right? But to be like, you shouldn't be that way. You should kind of look at things honestly and assess them honestly. So let's continue.
Yeah, doesn't it go against much of what is taught in martial arts by normal instructors?
Well, I guess because in most of them, they are so doggone stubborn, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, well, 200 years ago, I am taught like this, therefore, you know, if you maintain that type of attitude, I mean, you had it. I mean, we will be still back in, I mean, we will never grow because, I mean, learning is discovery thing. It's a constant discovery thing.
Yeah.
If we follow the old method, it is a continuous repetition of what is being handed down several hundred years.
So, yeah, really interesting saying, you know, people are kind of very proud about talking about they're doing this thing because this is how it was done 200 years ago. And to a certain degree, I feel like the Wing Chun family is very stuck on this. All right. The so many lineages within Yip Man Wing Chun are always like talking about how important it is that the lineage they are learning from that was the first or the second student of Yip Man or they were like great at all these fights and stuff like that and making still basing all of their claims on things that happened a very long time ago. Now, look, when you look back at your history and your lineage, for sure you're going to be proud of it. It's the one that you're from. But you have to respect the people that you came from. You have to build on that. You're not allowed to, for the rest of the days, just talk about the so-called good old days, which existed before you were even born. All right. And so I find that within Chinese martial arts, maybe Wing Chun in particular, so many Wing Chun people are, you know, when you tell them why is Wing Chun great, they're going to tell you a 60 something year old story. You know what I mean? And it's like, what does Janet Jackson say? What have you done for me lately? All right, okay.
Yeah.
And so if you want to, if you really want to respect those people in the past who really did all these great things, and let's say in the Wing Chun lineage, then you got to now do something to bring that conversation forward, to bring your art forward, to improve the way it's taught, to improve the way it's perceived, to improve the way you do it for the next generation, and not just go, yeah, well, Wing Chun is so great because in the 1950s, a bunch of teenagers who did Wing Chun beat up a bunch of teenagers who did another martial arts style, right? And then go,
okay, all right.
Then I always invoke the Janet Jackson question, all right? Okay, let's continue.
Came back to where, Los Angeles?
Where now?
1958, you came back to Los Angeles?
1959, I went to San Francisco
first. Uh-huh.
And then I went up to Seattle.
Oh, that's right, then you went to school. When did you become a professional actor?
That's a very funny story. Because when I went back to the States, you know, I really didn't think, I mean, here I am, not prejudiced or anything. Realistic thinking. How many times in film is the Chinese required?
Right.
When it is required, it is always branded as the typical, you know, Tang Lan Sa Lan Tang Tang type, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I say, hell with it, you know? However, in 1964, in Long Beach, International Karate Tournament, I gave a demonstration. And at that time, William Dozier was doing the bad man, and you know, the that, you know, and he saw it. So, you know, signed me up, and I did the Green Hornet, and then I went on and, you know, did that long.
Yeah, so, you know, he talks about kind of at first he didn't really have those ambitions about being an actor because, yeah, when you looked around in the States, I mean, they weren't really using Chinese actors for anything. And when they did, it was always in that very stereotypical fashion, you know, the kind of branded in the time of like the coolie from, you know, building the railroads and stuff like that. And that was definitely not what Bruce Lee wanted to do. And then he kind of retells the story about doing that demonstration in 1964, and then William Dozier, who's doing Batman, saw him, and then originally it was for the, I think, the Charlie Chan number one son. That's what he did that famous screen test for, and then he didn't get that, and then, but they, when they were going to do Green Hornet, they had him for that, and yeah, they had him in mind for that, and then that's kind of how that whole thing there, so it was really, again, accident of fate, right? So let's continue.
That's all, the other was longer than that. And then it went into rerun in the Orient and did much better than it did in this country, did it?
Well, in a way, it established me here in Hong Kong. You know?
Yeah. And then in 19, you stayed in the States, did some Long Street episodes, and then...
Did you see the one that I taught James Franciscus?
No, I didn't see that. I heard about it, though. I heard about it, though.
You know?
Yeah.
You get a chance to, paramount to show it to you.
Right.
Because it's, I mean, it's worth seeing, really, really, because, I mean, at that one, you know, Sterling Philippon, you know, right. Him and I, we sit down and we wrote that thing together, you know.
You and James Franciscus?
Yeah.
No, him and Sterling Silliphant, not James Franciscus, right? But it's so funny. It's
I'm like, wait, what did I miss right
there? Yeah, no. Definitely there's some lost in translation stuff there. So.
James Franciscus is who?
James Franciscus is the actor that, the guy who plays the blind guy in Long Street, right? but Bruce right. said he wrote all that stuff with Sterling Silliphant, and then, you know, and then Alex Benbox. Yeah, right. James Franciscus, right? It was like, no, it's Sterling Silliphant. But anyway... But yeah, but those episodes that he did of Long Street, you really hear Bruce's Jeet Kune Do philosophy in there. He demonstrates some Chi Sao and stuff like that. And he did, I think, the first one before Big Boss or maybe after, I don't remember. And then he came back and did a couple more. And those are really great. But it's also such a sign of the times. It's like, you've seen it? No, I haven't seen it, but I've heard about it. Okay, well, go ask Paramount to show you, right? Because you're a reporter, you could maybe get the credentials, right? But like nowadays, it would be like, yeah, just it's on that one streaming app. You can go watch it. But back then, if you miss something on TV, what are you
going to
do? Like, what are you going to do? You remember growing up, like, if you miss something, you know, like every Friday, there was like a Dukes of Hazzard episode that you wanted to watch, and if you missed it,
you got to wait for the...
You got to wait for the reruns or whatever, and then you got to read in the TV guide, when are they going to show that one episode you wanted to see, right? It's like nowadays, it's like...
Or you got to go to the TV museum.
Yeah, or you got to wait 20 years because it was the 90s and, you know, you only had VHS.
That's right, that's right.
And then it's like, oh, they got it out on DVD. Yeah. I can finally see that one episode I missed all the right, way back.
That's right,
you just got to wait it out.
Yeah, all right, let's continue.
It's called, in fact, the name is called The Way of the Intercepting Disc. That's the name of the episode.
Oh.
They asked me, you know, they asked me to go back, you know, to do a television series. Mm-hmm. Warner Brother was committed, you know, I mean, they were offering me $25,000 to hold me to do a television series.
This was after Green Hornet.
Do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then I went back to Hong Kong in 71 and did a movie called The Big Boss.
Right.
And the damn thing just broke the all-time record.
Yeah, so there was like there was a chance where he was going to get like kind of a regular contract to do the stuff with Longstreet and to do other things. But then Big Boss became such a big hit and that kind of changed the direction he wanted to go because, quite frankly, movies way better route for Bruce Lee because TV is so formulaic and after some time you're basically just kind of spinning your wheels doing the same thing anyway. Wow. Yeah, okay, let's continue.
Chow?
Yes.
And the director was Lo Wee?
Yes. Lo Wee.
How much did the film cost to make, you know?
How much it cost to make that film?
Yeah.
Very cheap.
What is very cheap?
Around 500,000 Hong Kong, which is like less than 100,000 US.
And how much did it make?
It grossed in Hong Kong alone, let's see, around 500,000 US.
Wow.
Now, so it broke all time record, you know? And then, yeah, I mean, all the time before, Chinese scripts were kind of like, you know, unrealistic and
yes.
Really, I mean, overacting and a lot of jumping around and, you know, I mean, not, well, anyway, all in all, it's not real, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's basically talking about, I mean, I think it was made for like less than $100,000, right? I mean, even wow. Back then, that wasn't really a lot of money, right, for a film. And, you know, made 500, you know, in Hong Kong alone, right? Which is like huge. And but that was his first movie, like if Fists of Fury made even more than that, right?
Yeah.
And I think that Bruce Lee, I think, was paid 15,000 US for the first two movies.
Mm-hmm.
That was his contract. He got 15,000 to do Big Boss and Fists of Fury, right? So basically 7,500 films, something like that, right? So, yeah, not
that's
really.
Why, that's not why had that beef with Raymond Chow. Like, yo, man, you guys make it 500K.
Yeah, that's
throw
right.
Me some,
exactly, you know, exactly.
Give him the
right?
Car.
Yeah, 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 here, have a car.
Yeah.
I'm going to build my studio
yeah.
With all this money that we're making from these movies. Here, you can have my old car, right? All right, cool. So there's still a little bit left to this interview, but I think why don't we go ahead and save that for a part two? How does that sound?
I mean, how much did we get through?
We got through enough. I think that's good. I think we'll go ahead and do a part two, and then well, it helps us stretch out our content, man.
Ooh, you're right.
But we'll do the part two like in 13 episodes, so we'll make people wait for
from
it
from now.
Bit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. All right.
Cool.
Sounds like a plan, Sifu.
And that's all I got to say about that. All right, Kung Fu Genius fans, well, I hoped you liked that. Let me know if there are other conversations out there, whether it's with Bruce Lee or anyone else in the martial arts that you would like me to cover. And of course, write your comments below. Any questions or things you want us to do in a future episode, we'll be super excited to hear about that. And I'll see you guys next time.
Word is I'm a Kung Fu genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpassed us. Your Kung Fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the victor.
Righty, righty, righty.
Go, blimey, governor,
ain't
on the
that a pisser? Alright, okay.
Australian?
It's the same, it's the same. Dre, you can do it.
You can do it,
right? I don't care what Mikey says. You're a human being and you deserve dignity.
All right, P-ha. All right, P-ha. All right, peeps. All right, peeps. On today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be discussing the Alex Ben Bla... Wait. Did it stutter? Did it stutter? The genius will be discussing the Alex Ben Block episode with the Bruce Lee guy. Bruce Lee interview episode of the episode of interviews. The Alex Blen. Bim Bimma. Who the keys to the Bimma?
Come on, Missy Elliott. Let's get this done.
The Alex Binblock Bruce Lee episode. Lots of gems. What? That was good. Lots of Jay Tunjo. The Alex Blen Block. Black Ben. And Zen. And Zen.
He just became German. And Zen.
And Zen.
And Zen, we finished the damn Zen intro, Dre. Would you like to finally finish the intro? Oh.